All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here for the next episode of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. This is episode 74. Yep, 74. And U.S. Women's National Team legend Shannon McMillan, she was born in 1974. Shannon scored key goals in the 1996 Olympics semifinal and final, as well as the game-winning goal in the 1999 Women's World Cup group game against North Korea. She's number 8 on the all-time scoring list for the U.S. WNT with 60 goals, and she's number 7 on the list for assists with 50. Heather O'Reilly passed McMillan on the list earlier this year. Shannon played in Portland before it was so widely known as Soccer City USA, and she was part of the University of Portland team that reached the NCAA final in 1995, the first pilot team to reach the final, falling to Notre Dame 1-0 in the third overtime period. So two conversations today, one new and one not so new. First, I chatted with freelance play-by-play announcer Jonathan Yardley about his experiences in the broadcast booth calling both men's and women's soccer games, including the U20 Women's World Cup in 2014 and many women's college soccer games, including this month's American Athletic Conference semifinals and final. Full disclosure here, I've known Jonathan since he was a freshman at Rice University, where I was the publications advisor and he wrote for the student paper. At one point, I noticed he had a MetroStar screensaver on his computer, and I don't think we've stopped talking soccer since. The other conversation in today's episode is nearly 2 years old, but I'm sharing it now for a couple of reasons. For one, it's from the very first women's soccer podcast I recorded back in February 2014, back before I had even come up with the name The Mix Zone, and I suspect that many of the listeners of this podcast have not heard this segment before. And with the announcement of the Houston Dash just a few months before that first podcast, I wanted that episode to help fans, especially Houston women's soccer fans, understand how we got from the 1999 Women's World Cup to having an NWSL franchise in Houston nearly 15 years later. My partner in this conversation is Joe Offenbacher, one of my trusty co-hosts from the live Keeper Notes soccer show. This was a pretty long chat, so today's episode features just the first half. Next week's episode will include the second half, and I hope you enjoy it. All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper, here with a very special guest from the TV side of things, Jonathan Yardley, freelance play-by-play announcer. Would you say announcer, Jonathan?
Yeah, announcer works, absolutely.
Announcer, yeah. I mean, you can call yourself whatever when you're freelance, but Jonathan has a long history in soccer and also women's soccer, having called the Under-20 Women's World Cup in 2014, also calling some U.S. women's game and a lot of college women's soccer. So, you know, Jonathan, thanks for joining me today.
Of course, anytime.
Well, and big question is, how did you get into calling sports and specifically calling soccer?
Well, you're going to know some of these answers because you knew me way back when when I matriculated at Rice University back in 2001, and I knew I wanted to be involved in sports somehow, and Rice had a great baseball program, and when I went to the baseball program and asked what are the options to be involved, they mentioned being the team manager, which involved a lot of videotaping, a lot of laundry. I wasn't really sure that was for me, and then they said, well, our radio broadcasters are graduating next year, and I said, perfect. I'll do that. And so I was lucky enough to get involved with that my freshman year at Rice. And by my junior and senior year, I knew enough people at school to kind of push to do some very low-budget, one-camera, one-microphone soccer broadcast.
And Rice Soccer started the same year that you did at Rice.
Yeah, that was my class. They had, what, 12 or 14 freshmen that came in my year. That was the very first year of the program. And so to see them go from this brand-new team to, by my senior year, making the NCAA tournament was really fun. I got to call the WAC tournament one of those years up in Dallas in terrible conditions. I know Jen was there, so she remembers. so it was a lot of fun to be that involved in college. And then somewhere along the line, I got the idea that I could do it beyond that. I was mostly thinking in baseball, but I always, having grown up playing baseball and soccer, you know, as equals, I always wanted to call soccer. There just weren't the entry-level opportunities at the time. Eventually, I went from minor league baseball to the Dynamo front office, where I could call Houston Dynamo reserve games. That was how I would get a soccer demo tape. And then I was able to transition to doing Houston Dynamo Radio, and now here I am still in soccer, whatever, 7 years later.
Now, how did you get the opportunities doing, like, say, the under 20 Women's World Cup?
So, freelance opportunities come from anywhere and everywhere. In my case, I had worked with some ESPN people when I was with the Dynamo, had stayed in touch with them when I left the team. They knew I was in broadcasting. They knew this was something I was interested in. To be honest, they contacted me earlier that year, Chris Alexopoulos and Amy Rosenfeld, who anyone who's worked with them will tell you are great people. They contacted me earlier in the year and said, would you be interested in calling some NWSL games? And I said, yes, absolutely. And I had watched a little NWSL, but I confess at the time I had not watched a lot. I knew who had won the title in the first year and everything, but I was no expert, and I'm probably still not. But so that year I watched a ton of NWSL. Every time it was on, you know, I'm watching the game and taking notes. This is all for the chance that I might call a game, right? There's no guarantee.
Right, because at that point they weren't sure what the TV deal was going to be for 2014.
Right, and even if ESPN definitely had the semifinals and final, at that point I didn't know that I was getting it, right? I hadn't worked for ESPN at this point. So late July comes around and I'm like, well, I haven't heard anything. This can't be good. And I finally got either an email or a phone call, I can't remember, saying, how would you like to call the under 20 Women's World Cup? So totally out of left field, different set of players and teams and personnel altogether. But of course, I was up for it. And so I spent the next 2 or 3 weeks just immersing myself in, you know, I'm watching YouTube feeds of under 17 finals, you know, France, North Korea, whatever I could get my hands on to know who the personnel was so that I was prepared for that tournament.
And that's got to be really hard to find some of that information, especially on the women's soccer side. I mean, let alone a youth tournament where there's not going to be a lot of video or information out there, but a women's youth tournament, you know, foreign countries that, you know, we know that they all kind of hide the North Koreans anyway. They never want to, you know, want the rest of the world to see what their players are doing. But just in general, to be able to get enough footage to know these players well, that's got to be a challenge.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was, you know, 30 minutes at a time before you'd have a breakthrough. Oh, here's a game with five players from the French team in it, and then you're only watching those five. You're not watching the rest of the field because you know those are the ones that are relevant to you. And searching for footage from the Asian Under-19 Championship from the year before, a lot of times Western characters didn't work. You had to try and find just the right terms and use Google Translate to search for it in Chinese, and then it would come up. So I went through some strange stuff to get background on those teams, for sure.
So you probably have some insight on those players that, like, nobody else in the country would have.
There were a few during the World Cup this summer where I was like, I recognize her, and I remember her. And it didn't even mean that I called their games, because there were a lot of games at the tournament I didn't get to call. The U.S. not making it to the semifinals actually meant that we didn't call the semifinals and final. They took the world feed.
So
I was preparing the whole time to call France, to call Canada, whoever would make it to the semifinals. And then when the U.S. got knocked out, unfortunately for everybody involved, except perhaps those who prefer the world feed, it meant we didn't get to call the semifinals and the final.
Well, one thing I always resent about the world feed is it's usually just one person talking. And I prefer whenever it's possible that it's two people, so at least you have a little bit back and forth. And, you know, all the games that you called in that tournament, you did have a partner. I think you did a couple games with Tony DiCicco.
I must say, I worked with just about everybody in that tournament. We only had six games, and I worked with Tony, with Julie Foudy, with Kate Markgraf, and Monica Gonzalez on the two Mexico games. So I was the one steady person, and the others were rotating through as their schedules would allow. I was the only one whose schedule was free for every game.
And when you watch the world feed, you know, on a game that you didn't get to call, I mean, are you kind of calling the game in your head?
In that particular case, where, again, I was looking at games with the thought process of I may see this team later in the tournament, I wasn't so much calling it in my head as I was trying to familiarize myself with the players. And so, for instance, China-Brazil, right? The U.S. opened against Germany. We call the game from the studio. We go back to the hotel, and China-Brazil is on. And I know these are the next two teams the U.S. is playing. And so I'm watching that, and I'm just calling out names. You know, sitting there out loud in my hotel room saying, Leticia Zhang Fei, when it turns over. Just to get myself familiar with who the players are on each team, what they look like, what distinguishing characteristics you can pick up off a TV monitor, so that when I'm calling it off a monitor 3 days later, I don't have to think, I don't have to look down at my notes, I at least can come close to knowing who it is right away.
And I think a lot of fans don't realize that many times in soccer, and I'm sure in other sports, the announcers are not at the venue. So you were in studio calling these games, correct?
Yeah, correct. For the under-20s, even though it was just up in Canada, we were in studio. And you're right, this is increasingly common, not just in soccer, but in all sports, right? Because the rights to call events cost even more these days, and companies are looking for ways to save money. And honestly, soccer, it's much easier to call up a monitor than other sports. There's less going on that's off camera, that's off the field. You don't have to worry about a pitcher warming up in the bullpen. You don't have to worry about, too often, an injured player at the end of the bench while play is still going on. So there's a lot of things in other sports that you have to be in the building to see, or have to have a connection in the building to see and relay to you. It's not perfect doing it off a monitor, but I think soccer is probably best suited for it.
And then how do you prepare going into a game where you know neither of the teams? I mean, we've talked a little bit about this, of course, with the Under-20 Women's World Cup, but with college soccer, where that's going to be even harder to find a lot of information, or rather a lot of footage, you know, these players are so young, to just be thrown into, okay, you're doing this conference tournament, you've got 4, maybe even 8 teams that you have to know their rosters really well, depending on how much you're calling. What's your process for getting to know those rosters?
Well, you and I have talked about this some, and I'm sure anyone can understand. You know, I don't want to sound creepy, but I Google every player.
Right? You have to.
And it's bad when you're a guy and you're Googling all these teenage girls, but I need to know the background. I need to know that Savannah Jordan has a black belt in Taekwondo. I need to know why Cassie Weldon plays midfield, not goalkeeper like her sister. And some players you get absolutely nothing, but some players you get the hometown article, you know, from their signing day or when they won Player of the Year. And it gives you one little nugget that you can throw in that kind of makes that player unique, and that can really make a viewer sit up and be, hey, that's kind of interesting, and attach that story to a number or a ponytail or a face that they see on the screen.
Because a lot of times when I read the media guides, you know, and the college sports information departments do a great job of putting out really thorough media guides, but sometimes I feel like the stories get lost, where it's just inundated with stats or the silly questions of, like, if you could be anywhere in the world, where would you be? Or, you know, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? Stuff that's not necessarily germane to the broadcast. So finding that other information, I think, is just really key.
Agreed, especially for the off-the-field stuff. And then the other key piece of information that I think a lot of sports information directors aren't able to share, and there's various reasons for that. I mean, half the time it's because the coach doesn't want them to share it, but is exactly where the player plays and what type of player she is. For a sports information director, you have 3 choices: defender, midfielder, and forward for any field player in soccer. But as you know, as anyone who's watched the game a lot know, there's so many intricacies that go in there, and the player can be listed as a defender/midfielder. Well, she could be a center back who also plays D-mid. She could be an outside back who also plays wide midfield. She could be a midfielder who plays both interior and outside, or she could be somebody who specializes on the wing. You're almost never going to get that from a sports information director. You really have to be able to find footage of the team, watch them, and usually you want to find more than one game, because players will rotate a great deal over the course of a season. So finding any video footage you can when there's not a lot available is really crucial.
And of course, talking to the coaches is huge, and generally the coaches are made available. How open they are when they talk to you is another thing. I mean, the game I called in Georgia more than a week ago, one coach, we couldn't get him to stop talking, but it was great because I felt like I knew his team. The other coach kept it very close to the vest. It was harder to find, you know, stories along that team, because he didn't want to share that information.
Yeah, absolutely. For the most part, they're very open, although as you experienced when it gets down to crunch time, some of them clam up a little bit.
Yeah.
And certainly, we never root on the air, right? And we never, honestly, I go into a broadcast, I just want a good game. I don't care who wins. But sometimes you can develop an affinity for a team because the coach was more open and shared more stories with you, or, you know, was just able to provide you more help. And you know that if they win, they'll be more helpful to you preparing for the next game. So sometimes you don't mind seeing a certain team win if they have been helpful in preparation. But for the most part, I think, especially in soccer, coaches feel their sport doesn't get a lot of attention. You know, the ACC is on TV every week. The SEC now is on TV almost every week. The Pac-12 is, maybe the Big Ten. Even those ones are very open. And when you go beyond that, those schools are very rarely on TV. So they're excited to get a chance to talk about their kid, kids talk about their program, and most of them understand that this is a way for their program to be represented to a larger community. They want you to do that accurately. They want you to know if their team has been unlucky all season, if their team has been especially resilient. Whatever the storyline of their season is, they're usually willing to share it with you, and that goes a long way, because it is difficult to find out just from the box scores and the recaps what's been going on.
Yeah, it was satisfying for me to check the NCAA scores from this past weekend and see that the team that had won the Sun Belt Conference final that I called actually won their first NCAA game.
Like, they didn't just win.
They thrashed.
They ripped it up.
Yeah. It was just really great to see that.
Yeah, LSU is not a bad team. They have really good forwards with Summer Clark and Jorian Bauckham, and South Alabama crushed them 4-0. I was really impressed by the scoreline. I wasn't surprised that South Alabama won. I was surprised how emphatically they won.
And for the third time in a row, they're going to be facing Florida State in the NCAA tournament. Their two previous trips, they met them immediately, and that's one of the things that we talked to the coach about. It's like, okay, you don't want to look ahead of the final, but we've got to talk about the NCAA tournament. And I loved his vision that, you know, he's like, I feel like I'm playing for the Sun Belt Conference as much as for South Alabama, because we want to show that we're worthy of hosting a game. And so that was the first time this past weekend that any Sun Belt team had hosted an NCAA game. You know,
yeah, and you called the Sun Belt women, I called the Sun Belt men the following weekend, and everybody from the conference was waiting to see how South Alabama would do, was proud that they were the first soccer team to host an NCAA game. And when I talked to them on Sunday, they were pretty pumped up that they had won.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's those college stories, you know, they really get you. It's so easy to connect, you know, to these people. And I enjoyed calling that game, being thrown into a situation where I wasn't immediately rooting for either team. It was a very kind of new situation to be in, where having been part of the broadcast team for the Dash the last two seasons, well, you know, of course, we're coming from the angle of the Dash. We work hard to be as unbiased as possible, but still, we're the home broadcast. We're here right. Doing that conference final. There is no home broadcast.
Yeah, and that's, I know exactly what you mean, because I grew up, or I came up in broadcasting, calling Rice baseball games. You're clearly rooting for Rice. Then I was calling minor league baseball, where I was working for the team. Then I'm calling Dynamo games, where I'm working for the team. And your feeling before the game is being nervous for the team. Your feeling after the game is up if they won, down if they lost.
Right.
And now, I'm in, what, my fourth year freelancing. I go home feeling high or low, depending on how the broadcast went. how I did, how my partner did, how our technical team did. And it's a good feeling to have control of that, right? Because I could have the greatest broadcast in the world, but if the Dynamo lost, I was going to go home bummed out.
Right.
Now, I get to go home if I feel like I did my job well. You know, I can feel proud of that. So it's nice to have control of that. On the other hand, it's probably not quite as high a high or as low a low as being up and down with the team.
But what would you say your highest high has been, other than calling Rice winning the College World Series or Alex Dixon's goal for the Houston Dynamo?
Oh, well, you took the obvious one.
Well, right. I had to take that one out of the...
Yeah. And the College World, I mean, they're both incredible in their own way. The College World Series is something that'll always be with me. I mean, I think the Alex Dixon goal is part of this, right? The Dynamo's run to the MLS Cup in 2011 was incredible for me. It was a great series of games. There were big goals scored late. I got to call them. I think I did okay with them. And I knew it was going to be my last season with the team. So emotionally, I was really swept up in that. And so the win at Kansas City to go to the MLS Cup was just incredible. But taking rooting interest out of it, you know, talking about games where I was in neutral, I think the first MLS game I did on ESPN2, which was last fall, Dallas-LA, had to be the high, because I've never been as nervous for a game in my life as I was for that. You know, I'd been on TV, but not to this level, not in front of, you know, kind of the MLS audience that had been the audience I had worked in front of for a long time, but not in front of everybody, not on the ESPN game.
Right.
I was so nervous. And to go through that game, have what I felt was a satisfactory performance for my first game at that level, and to have like a late winning goal to get to call, made it a really, really good night. And I got some nice messages, as I said, from both Amy and Chris, and Brian Dunseth, who was my partner that night, and a lot of people that I worked with to get all those messages of support from people around the game was incredible.
Yeah, that's got to be a great feeling. Well, how much do you get to watch NWSL, you know, post your slight chance of calling NWSL? So that was 2014. I mean, were you able to watch it all much during 2015?
Yeah, I did. I'll say I tuned in more after the World Cup. I think, like anybody else, knowing that the personnel was 100%.
Right.
But also, that happens to be my particular schedule, had me busy covering baseball and softball and MLS in the spring. But so I did get to watch down the stretch. I got to watch some of the playoffs. You know, I'm really glad to see Orlando coming in. I'm glad to see the league keep moving what I feel is forward. There continue to be talks of other expansion. I think dealing with two major tournaments every 4 years instead of one, as you do in the men's game, makes it tough on a summer schedule. But I think we all understand a summer schedule is the best model for the women's league. So, I watch it. I root for the teams to do well and draw big crowds and be entertaining. You know, the Michelle Betos goal, when she came forward late in that game over the summer, that was one where I was just flicking around soccer games. I didn't feel like going to bed yet, and the Thorns were still playing, and I flipped it on, and there's Michelle Betos. So I remember seeing the year before when Onger was hurt, you know, and to see her come all the way up the field and score that was, you know, it's just one of those fun late night, holy crap, did I just see that moment?
Right. You're like, wait, was that real?
Yeah. And I think because it came after the MLS games were over for the night, it got a few more soccer fans like me.
Right.
You know, whenever you're the only game going on, and those of us who just love watching soccer, we'll keep an eye on all the leagues and know what game is on. Anytime you're the only game going on, you get a moment like that, it's a big step forward. So that was really cool to see.
Now, as you're watching these games, do you ever feel kind of partial to the girls from, you know, North Jersey? Because, you know, that's where you grew up, you know, so it's like, do you root a little bit more for maybe Tobin Heath or Heather O'Reilly?
Oh, I'm a big Jersey. I'm a proud New Jerseyan. I live in New York now, but I'm one of those people who will proudly say I'm from Jersey. I know Tobin Heath High School is one county over from mine, but I've seen them play sports many times. So I got to call U.S. France last year, and I tweeted something about North Jersey products being there. So yeah, absolutely. I forget where they're from after a certain point. Once they're with the national team, you kind of you see them as big time players. But there's a couple that I definitely remember.
Well, and watching the World Cup this summer, one of the things I enjoyed for the games that I saw on TV was just the coverage is so much better. I mean, I know it's part of that's the money, that there's more cameras. I think our crews in the U.S. have gotten so much better at shooting soccer. You know, I go back and watch my old tapes from '99, and there's way too many like cut to the crowd shots, and it felt like the coverage here was so respectful of the game, and like how much more can we show of the field and other angles, and you know, how many more former international players can we bring in to be announcers? You know, I would say that was probably the only excess, where it's like, wait, that's way too many people sitting around a couch, you know, in Vancouver. But I feel like Fox really brought it this summer.
They did, and I think ESPN had taken that attitude for 2011 as well, which I think was a huge deal. It's one of those, where were you when Abby Wambach scored to tie the Brazil game?
Right.
And I think Fox definitely carried on, you know, putting resources into it, right? Treating it like a big deal, because it is a big deal. They put announcers on it who were going to give it time and attention it deserves. They put together a studio team with great experience from multiple backgrounds, right? It wasn't just Americans
right.
watching the game. We got to hear from Ari Hinks. We got to hear from Kelly Smith. So it was a blast to watch it this summer. I got unlucky in that the U.S. Open Cup games that I was calling happened to match up with two U.S. games. And so I was down in Philadelphia calling an Open Cup game with Jill Lloyden during the U.S.-Germany semifinal.
Oh, poor Jill.
Right, exactly. And so as a former U.S. national team player, she knows all these girls. She's rooting for them. And we love the Open Cup. We love what we're doing. And we were watching our game, but I'm not going to lie. We had U.S.-Germany on the iPad, and Jill would grab me by the shoulder, and I look over, and there's the penalty kick, and I'm trying to call one game and will the German girl to miss at the same time.
Well, it worked, clearly.
Yes. So we were pretty excited there during what I'm sure was a fairly routine part of the Open Cup game. Jill and I were really pumped up based on what we were seeing on the iPad.
I'm going to have to go back and watch that and try to figure out when that was.
If you can find out when it is, I'll be really impressed.
Well, Jonathan, thanks for sharing your stories about behind the scenes, you know, calling games and your angle on women's soccer. Really appreciate it. And hope, you know, hopefully maybe you can get into some NWSL games or maybe Women's World Cup 2019.
Of course. You know, I love calling soccer, men's or women's. I'll be watching the league whether I'm calling it or not. But it would be fun to work some more games. Absolutely.
All right, welcome to the first ever Women's Soccer Podcast by Keeper Notes. Jen Cooper here, the keeper herself, with Joe Offenbacher, and we're going to talk, obviously, women's soccer. But more importantly, we're going to talk about how we got here, how we got from the 1999 Women's World Cup to Houston having an NWSL team 15 years later.
Yes, which is always important to put all that into perspective, because you don't just start with, hey, we have the dash, let's go, right? You have to go. In order to know where you're at, you have to know where you've been and what it took to get there. And who better to tell you this piece of Houston history than Jen Cooper, the keeper herself?
Well, we did Houston Dash Day yesterday, and I got to moderate the Q&A, and it was a lot of fun, but it was also interesting to me that there's a lot of people, a lot of hardcore women soccer fans of a younger age, but they don't know where this league fits kind of in the history of women's soccer, or, you know, how this is different from the other ones. I've had people say to me, you know, it's like, well, why are there two women's leagues? Like, well, there's one top women's league, and then there's a couple of semi-pro women's leagues. There's, you know, when we have such a crowded sports landscape, these leagues don't get a lot of media coverage. So people don't know the way that you could ask anyone on the street how many teams are in the NFL, and I think they would be able to answer correctly.
The majority would
right. Even if they don't follow it, they're aware of it. So here's a different situation where it's the U.S. women's team has seen so much popularity, especially with the 2011 Women's World Cup and the gold medal in 2012, and kind of the breakout stars of Alex Morgan and Hope Solo and Abby Wambach and Sydney LaRue and Megan Rapinoe. But people don't necessarily understand the league concept. You know, so you've got, yeah, I'm supporting them for the national team. What does this league concept mean? So
and how does it fit into the national team concept? Because that's the other piece, I think, Jen, that for the common fan, and I hate that term in the sense of common fan, but the person that doesn't follow it to the depth of a junkie, a nerd, if you will, of somebody that
hashtag soccer nerd. I admit it.
Well, exactly. And that fits most of us that do keeper notes, right? We're always doing something. But you have a degree of women's soccer in this country really hitting big with the 99 World Cup, right? Everybody, no matter how superficial they may or how in-depth they may know women's soccer, knows Brandi Chastain.
Yeah, they'll be like, the girl that took her shirt off? Well, yeah. that tournament?
The women won, and one of them took her shirt off, and there was a sports bra involved. And
let's start there. Even though there's a good 14 years of women's soccer history for the U.S. national team before that, let's start there. That's a great starting point. So the U.S. women win the Women's World Cup 1999 final against China, 0-0, goes to overtime, still 0-0 at the end, goes to PKs. Brian Escurry makes an amazing save and saves one of the Chinese kicks, and Brandy is the last kicker for the U.S., nails it upper 90 with her left foot, immediately rips the jersey off, celebrations galore, you know, just 90,000 plus at the Rose Bowl is amazing, and the TV ratings were amazing. And so out of all of that came a group of investors led by John Hendricks of the Discovery Channel, who wanted to put together a women's league, saying, hey, we saw that. We think we can make something of this. So the WSA, the Women's United Soccer Association, was founded in 2000, and they announced eight teams. So the original eight franchises were Atlanta, Boston, Orlando, San Diego, San Jose, New York. I'm missing somebody. Philadelphia
was the other one.
Yeah. Right. Now they had to move Orlando to Carolina at the last minute because they couldn't find a good facility in Orlando. And they allocated the 20 players from the 1999 national team to those eight franchises, and then they added a couple of players that made the Olympics in 2000. So each team was starting off with three national team players, and then they picked up a lot of international players and did a college draft. And it was just, that was such an incredible time for me, as I was just so getting sucked into soccer, and to know that there was women's soccer news on a regular basis, it was such an interesting thing for me. I mean, I grew up with sports. I grew up watching a lot of sports and playing some sports, not really playing team sports until later. But you can't underemphasize, if that's the right word, what it's like to be in your late 20s watching this on TV and go, those women look like me. As much as people like say, oh, it's great that they're role models for 12-year-old girls, I felt for me as an adult, I was like, they look like me. I play soccer too. This is wonderful.
And that's something that I think is a key point for those of you listening out there that sometimes gets pushed to the background, because it's always, you hear this, oh, role models for the young girls coming up, which no doubt.
Okay. No doubt
it has its part. It's definitely a piece of why, especially from a male perspective, on the women's soccer side, there is such an involvement at all levels, from the players down to the young ladies that are just picking up the game. But Jen makes a great point on how does that relate to somebody that's in their 20s that has
or 30s or 40s,
but has played the game, and now is able to see this unfold, see this boost in popularity, see people getting behind it, starting a league, and it's like, hey, we now have a league. Because I can remember watching Women's World Cup before 99 when I was in Europe, and it was a mixed reaction across the board from a lot of soccer fans.
Yeah, it was in Sweden in 1995, and I think the crowds were like 3,000 to 10,000.
Right, and it was kind of interesting in the sense of, there's women's national teams, there's a Women's World Cup, but how do we really, as soccer fans in general, embrace this? Because let's be quite honest, sexist views, right? Male, female, men's soccer, women's soccer, they still exist to some degree today, but they were much different then because it was new. It was a newer thing.
Well, and it was a women's team sport where I think we're very used to supporting women's tennis players, women's figure skaters,
individual sports.
And also, I think as American sports fans, we get the once every 4 years you go crazy for your country. We're already used to the Olympic thing, so adopting the World Cup fanaticism, I don't think that was difficult. But then how do you take it to a weekend, week out, following your team? So the WSA kicked off in 2001, eight teams, some big sponsorships, also some big expectations, some big goals. And I kind of jumping ahead to the league folding. I get frustrated any time that someone writes something, a retrospective about WSA, or mentions it casually and say, oh, they blew through $100 million. That's nothing. That's nothing. It was eight teams and a front office over 3 years. That's nothing. And what often doesn't get said is that by the third year, they had reduced expenses so much and their revenues were rising. They just didn't have investors with the patience in the pockets. All their investors were public investors who were expecting a return on their investments. By contrast, MLS, if it were not for Lamar Hunt, Phil Anschutz, and Robert Kraft with their deep and privately held pockets, MLS probably would not exist. You know, at one point you had Anschutz owning, what, six of the 10 teams?
It'd be a very similar storyline as far as the MLS.
Where they gave it a go, they blew through X million dollars, and of course we won't ever hear those numbers from MLS since it's privately held. So three seasons with the WSA, the competition was amazing. The number of international players they were able to bring over was impressive. And such a competitive league. All the finals were great. First season, it was Atlanta beat San Jose Cyber Rays going into overtime. And this is when overtime was still golden goal. You didn't have to play the whole 30 if someone scored. But it was 3-3 at regulation, stayed 3-3 in overtime, went to PKs. Brandi Chastain's team won again. It was just amazing. It was an amazing final. 2002, you had Mia Hamm's team come from the bottom of the rankings from the season before, make it all the way to the championship match. And then the third season was really the blossoming of Abby Wambach. Mm-hmm. A lot of people forget, you know, where she started and that she wasn't just a natural on the national team to start. She got her first cap in 2001, graduated from Florida, so got drafted into the WSA in 2002. And I like to think if she didn't get drafted to Mia Hamm's team, the Washington Freedom, I really wonder if she would have developed into the amazing player right. that she is. She was already a solid player, and someone who, being larger than most of the other players, had used that to her advantage, but she hadn't taken it, you know, to the next level.
That leadership, yeah. You get that experience factor that Mia Hamm brought yeah. and was able to, you know, bring to Abby.
And so I think the combo of Mia and Abby, very similar to like Landon Donovan and Brian Ching, you know, that made both of those players better. Right. And then here Abby had someone saying, you know, you could be so much, you need to take it more seriously. I remember very clearly a doubleheader in 2003. It was a WSA game followed by a US-Canada game. And this was 6 months before the Women's World Cup. April Heinrichs, the coach, did not call up Abby Wambach for that match. Now, she still had to play the game before. So here's the national team she wants to be on right there.
Right.
And she's not called up for them. And you're thinking, you know, okay, this is where you prove April wrong. She had a horrible game for Washington Freedom. And I think that must have been the turning point for her. It's like, it's in my hands. I'm throwing it away. I have to change. Right. And you know, she has been a completely different player since then. Made the World Cup team, scored some goals, and, you know, 10 years later has the international goal record.
And yeah.
So that, in a nutshell, is why we need these leagues, is that Abby coming out of college was not quite something for the national team. She, you know, was diamond in the rough. Needed a lot of seasoning, right. a lot of push to become more of a leader, and I think that's what that league did for her. So right before the Women's World Cup in the fall of 2003, which actually got moved to the U.S. because of SARS in China, so we lucked out hosting the Women's World Cup twice in a row.
So things can happen for those of you that are going, it's going to be hot in Qatar. In December.
Yeah, I don't think SARS is going to happen in Qatar, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, that'd be kind of a stretch to get SARS there.
But. Keep dreaming, though. Keep dreaming. I am.
But back on point.
Yeah, back on point. So WSA had to shut down right before that Women's World Cup, and that was unfortunate. It got a lot of attention, but you know that just the money wasn't there, and the investors were not willing to stick around, especially when you're reporting to public companies that you're losing this much. There was kind of a half-hearted attempt the next summer to play some WSA friendlies and kind of gauge interest, but that really didn't come to nothing other than providing a couple more games for April Heinrichs to see players before the 2004 Olympics. All right. And you did have, in the break between the WSA, which ended in 2003, and the WPS, which launched in 2009 and founded in 2008, you had some effort from U.S. Soccer and Tanya Antonucci, who founded Women's Soccer Initiative, Inc., and she had a soccer background and also had a background with Yahoo Sports. So she was kind of going around and trying to put together a business plan and talking to cities and stuff like that and keeping the players in the loop. And so her work resulted in the WPS. And that was in conjunction with U.S. Soccer, because from U.S. Soccer's perspective, it's much cheaper for them to have a league where the players are getting high-level games week in, week out, than to have a two-month residency camp here and a two-month residency camp here and fly in international teams, and there's just so much cost to that. So WPS launched in 2009. I mean, they played their first games. They had, I think, seven teams the first season in some of the same venues, but not all of the same venues. And unlike WSA, these were all individual individual businesses, as opposed to WSA, they kind of shared profit together. So Boston Breakers and WSA had been the most successful team, but the teams that were losing money brought them down, right. You know. Washington Freedom playing at RFK was having great crowds, but RFK was so expensive it didn't matter, right. You know. So WPS was a little bit different, and that road was much rockier for a variety of reasons. So you had a good first season. You had Puma coming in doing custom kits for the whole league. You know, you had the best players playing in there. You had Marta, you know, joining from Brazil, along with our U.S. national teamers. But second season, we started to see kind of the cracks in the foundation. AEG, which had owned the L.A. Soul, and they were playing at Home Depot Center, they had said from the beginning, we're just going to do this 1 year, and they tried to sell the team, and then that sale fell through, so they just kind of pulled out of the league.
Right.
You know, and I remember just being so frustrated with that. It's like, why would you even do 1 year? You know, it's like...
But we, you know,
yeah.
Who knows? I mean, there's so much that you know, right? Yeah. That's public record.
And there's so much we don't know.
We don't know what's going on behind the scenes with them.
So they pull out of the league. Those players get dispersed to other teams. The good thing was that year, though, is that they added two teams. So they would have been a 9-team league. So they become an 18 league. So you're thinking, okay, they've still made a net gain. Good thing. But then about 7-8 weeks into the season, St. Louis Athletica has to fold because their investor can't make payroll.
Yeah, we don't want to get into
that'll
be a whole separate podcast.
That's a whole separate story, but that's a big reason that we're never going to see pro soccer in St. Louis. Those players were absorbed by other teams and they had to redo the schedule, and you know, so the league was getting nervous. And then at the end of the 2010 season, after FC Gold Pride, based in the Bay Area, had been last place in the first season, champions the second season, they had picked up MARTA, you know, had a great final. A month later, they're like, we're folding. Their investors, again, their intentions were great. Their pockets were not as deep as their intentions were great.
Which is a common theme across U.S. soccer for a long, long time.
Now, at least these investors were privately held. So it wasn't like you had, you know, public shareholders saying, you know, I want my money now. But their pockets just weren't as deep as their intentions were. So then Chicago Red Stars decided, okay, well, we're not going to play in 2011 either. And then the Washington Freedom is sold to Dan Borislav, Magic Jack, and he moves the team to Boca Raton. So 2011 was just, I mean, that's, again, there's a whole separate podcast there, the insanity of what became the team called Magic Jack.
How that contributed to
it's easy to blame the demise on WPS to just that. And seriously, we will do a separate podcast on that sometime just to vent our frustrations. but the league was already having other issues. Right. Carrying Marta's contract, she had a $500,000 guaranteed contract, which is ridiculous. I think they truly believe that by having the best players in the league, that would make a difference. But she was not someone who moved the needle on ticket sales. She couldn't do interviews in English. She's the best player in the world, but she's not that compelling story. She's not that, oh my God, she's not the Beckham, Henri, Hope Solo, Alex Morgan kind of person where you know just about enough about them that you're compelled to go see a game. You know, where Marta has to be, well, let me explain to you why she's so amazing. You know, so that league folded at the end of 2011, or actually at the beginning of 2012. They had said first they were going to suspend the season and try to continue operations, but with all the litigation that happened with Dan Borislav, and once again, that's a separate podcast, they had to, you know, they eventually just said, okay, we're shutting down. And, you know, again, you've just come off this amazing World Cup, that 2011 Women's World Cup, where we're in the quarterfinals against Brazil, we're down 2-1 in overtime,
and
123rd minute, Rapinoe cross, you know, kind of a Hail Mary cross, and Abby slots it in perfectly. I still love the image of like the keeper's hands are a foot away, and probably the thought in her head of like, no, we were just about to eliminate the U.S. You know, and then they make it all the way to the final. They lose on penalty kicks, but it was such an amazing run. And I think such a great breakthrough in that it wasn't just one player's tournament. It was the next iteration of the national teamers. You only had, I think Chrissy Rampone was the only player left from the 99ers. Just carrying on that legacy of excellence and, you know, in intense talent and competition. So with that and then the league folding, it's this kind of up and down. They had a great 2012, of course, the national team winning the gold medal. Another classic match, the semifinal against Canada. go into overtime, you know, last minute goal from Alex Morgan and all kinds of controversy with, you know, counting Aaron McLeod's seconds with the ball in her hands and Tancredi stepping on Carly Lloyd's head and all kinds of just awesome grudge match. So the women win the gold, and, you know, we don't know the beginning of, hey, how do we get a league started? But there were people that started talking, and it was different group from WSA, different group from WPS, except a couple of clubs. There have been some clubs that have existed the whole time. The Boston Breakers, right, for a long time, the Washington Freedom, have existed the whole time. When there wasn't a women's full pro league, they still had semi-pro league. They participated in W League or WPSL or did youth clubs or something like that. So Chicago Red Stars stayed, you know, between. Right. So at the end of 2012, they announced, all right, we're going to do the National Women's Soccer League, and it's going to be based out of U.S. Soccer's office. And this is the key difference between this and the other two leagues, is it's the federations running it. And when I say the federations, I mean U.S. Soccer, Canada Soccer, and FMF, Mexico Soccer. Because like we've already mentioned, it's cheaper for them to pay for the players to be in a league than to pay for residency camps over and over and over. They need the benefit of these players getting high level competition constantly. And I think about, you know, like we mentioned Abby Wambach, I also think about Shannon Box. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she went to Notre Dame, graduated in 2000, you know, had won an NCAA championship, but had never popped with the U.S. national team. Because of her time in the WSA, she gets seen by April Heinrichs. She gets called into camp. Her first cap as a U.S. national teamer is the warm-up game for the Women's World Cup. You know, that she didn't have a couple years worth of friendlies under her belt, but right, if she didn't have that time in the WSA, she would not have made the national team. And then she ends up playing in the FIFA All-Star game for women, and, you know, she's been such an amazing contributor to the national team. And same with WPS, okay? If Rapinoe didn't have the opportunity at WPS, we would not have seen her in the 2011 Women's World Cup.
Absolutely. And if American players would have to go overseas, mm-hmm, because there is nothing other than a residency here, you run that same thing. You could have a Megan Rapinoe that plays for Lyon or somebody that plays for PSG or Wolfsburg or whatever, you know, but to see them frequently, you just wouldn't have that same opportunity as you do when there's a league here. And that's why I think in this particular instance, what we've got going now with Mexico, the U.S., and Canada participating, it allows all three of those federations to keep their players closer. Now,
right,
does that mean on an individual basis that there's not a player that'll say, hand up, I'm going to go play in Australia, whatever, sure. But,
right,
you know, in a general context, and that's the thing that we have to keep in mind.
And it means that those seasons in other countries aren't very long, and so they're jumping around. And I also feel like it means that the national team program in general is very dependent on players of a certain economic level that can afford to play cheaply or can live at home with their parents or, you know, something like that.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. First, an update on Olympic qualifying for CONCACAF. The women's soccer warriors of Trinidad and Tobago topped St. Lucia 14-1 on aggregate to advance to the final four-team stage of Caribbean qualifying for Olympic qualifying. Wednesday, they'll meet Jamaica, while Puerto Rico faces Guyana in the semifinals. Wednesday's winners will earn berths to February's CONCACAF qualifying tournament, as well as a slot in Friday's Caribbean final. The two semifinal losers from Wednesday will meet in the third place game, and that winner will also qualify for the February tournament. Next, some kit notes from the keeper. Again, I've said this before, but it doesn't hurt to say it again. Do you want something with 3 stars on it for Christmas? Email me now so you can get it in time. Jen@soccerforall.com. That's J-E-N, and it's Soccer for All with the number 4. If you want a player name number on the back of a jersey, I may be able to help. I still have some USA Pro names in stock. I can order more, though the authorized vendor of those name sets can be really, really slow. So if you want something by Christmas, please email me now.
Keep in mind, I can also make NWSL keeper jerseys, and literally, I can put an NWSL club patch on anything that's Nike. So if you have something specific in mind, let me know. Next, NCAA Tournament Division 1, round of 32 games are this Friday. Round of 16 is Sunday. So there are 8 sites hosting these matches, and most, if not all, games will stream live via college or conference websites. Some may be on TV as well. For live scores and the interactive bracket, check out NCAA.com. You can also buy tickets for the College Cup, aka the Final Four, which will be held in Cary, North Carolina on December 4th and 6th. Those last three games, the semifinals and the final, will air live on ESPNU. Last thing for the back four, a teaser, actually. Next week's episode will include an exclusive interview with the one and only Ella Masser. KeeperNotes.com editor Hal Kaiser gets the scoop from Ella on her plans for the future, both on and off the field. So you're definitely going to want to listen to that one. As always, if you're not already subscribed to the Mix Zone, please do via iTunes. Just search for Howler. You can also find the podcast on TuneIn.com, Stitcher, Podomatic, HowlerMagazine.com. And please, if you like this podcast, let other people know. I'm pretty sure this is still the only weekly women's soccer podcast in the U.S. Week in, week out, for nearly 2 years now. So please spread the word. And of course, thanks to PK Ray and my very noisy cats in the background for making this podcast possible.